Time is precious, so let's get on with Dr. Tim Garvey, a good friend and a rising star in the Permanente Medical Group locally here. He's a great psychiatrist, so have him welcomed. And
good morning, everyone. Good morning. Is my mic on? Can you hear me? All right. My name is Dr. Tim Garvey. As Tom said, I am a psychiatrist for Kaiser Permanente. Was primarily doing outpatient psychiatry. I'm transitioning more into a role over in the hospitals right now, both over in Anaheim and the Irvine area. I grew up in Orange County. I actually remember Orange County when there were orange groves at one time. Grew up in Tustin, and I've been here at Friends Church since 2012. And I was thinking before coming on stage, and I've even talked about with some of my patients, you know, I love this church. I love this church for how welcoming it is to all new members who are coming to this church. But in particular, what I've told my patients is that this is a church that is open and transparent about this issue of anxiety, depression, of a mental illness, which is pervasive. It's throughout our community and something that needs to be talked about. And then talking about it is definitely the starting point for a healing process. So it's not something that I think we keep in silence at all in our church, which is good, and this is just awesome that we're doing this. So some of the goals that I hope that we can, or I can do during this lecture and throughout the whole day is to reduce stigma of depression. Mental illness definitely has its stigma compared to a lot of other medical illnesses. And also having an appreciation of the biologic part of depression. There's just been an explosion of neuroscience research, and the biology of depression is remarkable, and hopefully is going to lead into some new treatments that are definitely needed within the field. And but to have an appreciation of that this is something like any other medical illness, and in many ways is actually more complex than a lot of other medical illnesses. So, what is a psychiatrist? I put this slide up because when I went to medical school, I actually didn't know what was the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist. I didn't necessarily have the absolute goal when I went to medical school I was going to become a psychiatrist until I met a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Gerald McGuire, who's actually now dean over at UC Riverside's Med School. And I saw what he did not only for patients but also families. Just how they're in a desperate place and how he brought in hope into their lives. And it just touched me. It touched me in a way where I saw an appreciation, I thought, beyond all the other areas of medicine that I saw. And I was really drawn to it. And with the background and some of the neuroscience research I had done in the past, it ended up being a good fit. That was something I was going to pursue my residency and career in. For the training of a psychiatrist, we do go to medical school for 4 years. Then we do 4 years of residency, which is standard for adult psychiatrists. And for those who want to keep going, they can do an additional year for one of the subspecialties, whether it's geriatrics, child, and some of the other subspecialties. And we're not the only, I'm certainly going to talk about medications, but we're not the only clinicians who prescribe medications. A fair amount, actually the vast majority, are primary care physicians, do a lot of dispensing of antidepressants. Also, there are physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, too. So as I talk about how pervasive it is, 16.2 million Americans within the past year have had an episode of depression. The World Health Organization has identified depression as the leading cause of disability. And that's something that's been steadily on the rise and has recently actually reached that point. And another scary statistic is that the rate of suicide is going up, too. As you can see, in 2016, the Center for Disease Control also identified suicide as the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. So there's a lot of other medical illnesses. They don't necessarily have any type of stigma. You have someone who has a stroke. They have a cutoff of a blood supply to the brain. You have death of brain tissue. Heart attacks, a cutoff of a blood supply to the heart and death of cardiac tissue. Parkinson's, a loss of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra. These are all medical illnesses that don't necessarily carry the same amount of stigma as mental illnesses. People are more open and transparent talking about these things, whether it's a medication they're on for cholesterol or something that's controlling their diabetes. But you don't hear really the openness of people talking about maybe the antidepressant I'm on. Hey, what helped me? Talking to somebody who's maybe having a side effect on a medication, hey, maybe you should follow up with your doctor on that. So many people, they're in treatment and they're in silence. And hopefully that's something that we can kind of break down today. But I talked about the biology of depression, and it's amazing the things that are going on in the human brain. And that's what I meant, exceeding a lot of things that we see in a lot of medical illnesses. You have sleep circadian rhythm changes. If you took someone with depression and you put them in a sleep lab, and what they do in the sleep labs is they put all the kind of connect different things on the brain, do these polysomnographs, a person who's going through depression has distinct changes in their sleep. It's not a matter of hours or duration. The depth of sleep has changed, their sleep states have changed, and you'll often hear somebody who's going through depression about how exhausted they feel. Despite maybe if they've got in what appears as, you know, 6, 7, how many hours, the depth of sleep is not there. You see actual areas in the brain that are changed or smaller. That one of the areas in the brain, the hippocampus, which is critical for establishment of memory, is actually smaller in somebody who's having depression. And a lot of these changes that you see, the telomeres at their end of the caps on DNA, the connections between neurons, a lot of these start to heal with medications. You know, that talk about, you know, chemical imbalance, and it's a lot more complex than that. A lot of the medications can adjust the what we call neurotransmitters pretty quickly, but the delay time, which can be very frustrating, not only for patients, but also clinicians for recovery, it's due to a lot of these things that are actually starting to improve. Another hot area in research for mental illnesses is we're seeing also lots of inflammation that's going on in the brain. So some of the future medications that we're looking at are almost going to be anti-inflammatories for the brain, including some other mental illnesses other than depression. So what are things that people hear when they have a stigma with the stigma of depression? Just snap out of it. You need more faith. It's not a real disease. These are painful things that people hear, and they're suffering from something that's so disabling. Remember, the World Health Organization identified it as the number one cause of disability worldwide. And to hear these things are so painful, and yet I think the church is in a position that can break that down. And hopefully things like we're doing today can be a welcome area of healing. I like this quote. This is probably the last person I think you would say, get over it, this is all in your head. This is Oscar De La Hoya. For those of you who don't know him, he's a pretty good boxer. This is probably the last person I want to be in a ring with. His quote is, he suffered from clinical depression. This is the biggest fight of my life. I could put all my opponents in one ring and battle all of them. But this monster is going to be the toughest fight of my life. And there's a lot of other individuals who are well known in the public too who are coming out with depression, and they're talking about their battles with it. In fact, recently within the past few years, you might have heard Michael Phelps. He's won more medals than any other Olympian, and he's actually been open and transparent talking about his depression. And hopefully with that openness of individuals also encourages people to get help. Like I talked about, the church is in a unique position to be, you know, healing for those who have this. I mean, we can be in a position where we're not stigmatizing depression, but we're loving one another. We're praying for each other. We're encouraging each other to get help, to get treatment, to talk to your doctor. That's what we need. They have a fantastic men's study here called No Regrets. I did both years of it, and I'll tell you one of the most remarkable things I remember about it was it happened not the first time, but, you know, we met, you know, I think it was like the second or third time that we met is when somebody opened up about something going on in their life, like something private. We don't do that freely going into church. We all kind of put on our face like, hey, everything's fine with me, nothing's going wrong at home, But I remember this one person, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but when he opened up and was honest and transparent, healing began. Everyone opened up. We realized, wow, you too? You're suffering with this? You're going through this? And when there was that openness, we could connect with each other. We could pray for each other, and miracles happen. But we need to be in a place where we can do that, where we can have that openness and talk. I like this quote from this pastor that I found. Witnessing another's vulnerability was a catalyst for them to respond in kind. As we often discover in our church, it's amazing how one person sharing about her pain can lead to a snowball of others letting down their guards to do the same. Beautiful. Who suffers depression? Pretty much everyone suffers depression, all different ages, races, male, female, doesn't matter, financial status. There are some demographics that actually have higher rates of depression, whether they're young adults. There is a little bit of females more than males suffer from depression, but it is it's pervasive of all different demographics. So risk factors for depression. Early life experiences and traumas, parental separation, abuse have higher rates of depression. Certainly stressful life events that one goes through can be a trigger of depression. There's a strong connection with our stress response in the human body that can affect and cause some symptoms of depression just through kind of that fight or flight nervous system also that's going on. Social factors, genetics. That's another, you'll talk to someone and you find out that this is generational. You know, one of the things that we do for the first time we meet a patient is we find out about the family history, and you notice that this is happening generation after generation and might very well be the first person who's actually seeking, treatment in the family. And also medical illnesses, those illnesses that I listed, that the non-psychiatric illnesses like Parkinson's, stroke, heart attack, much higher rates of depression with all those. And a lot of the physicians that I work with really take depression seriously because it affects all the other health conditions that they're treating, whether it's compliance with medications, their ability to do many things. It's the mind-body integration, and it's an important part for us all working together in medicine. So what are the treatments for depression? I'll get probably a little bit more into the medications. Which is, what psychiatrists, that's one of the things that we do that some of our other clinicians in mental health care do not. We have therapy, certainly the spiritual healing that we've talked about, lifestyle changes, whether it's your nutrition, it's getting exercise can be significant for helping. And brain stimulation is another part that I'll talk about for treatment of depression. That's not medications, and some can be very effective. You might be familiar with some or maybe not. So when you see a psychiatrist in their initial evaluation, there's a lot of things that they're going to end up doing. First is going through the symptoms that one has, whether symptoms of anxiety, depression, whether it's patients that are treating have symptoms of psychosis, hearing hallucinations. In some cases, depression can be so severe they can have hallucinations. They don't necessarily have schizophrenia, but severe depression can have symptoms of psychosis. And certainly the history, psychiatric history, maybe past medications that they had, family psychiatric history, substance abuse, medications that they're taking. Sometimes medications can have side effects that can be of concern that maybe are contributing to it. And it's also important that we know that for interactions that might be with some of the medications that we end up prescribing. And also at times, the physical exam is generally not something we do often, probably more for assessing maybe sometimes side effects in medications. And certainly doing a list of labs at times to see whether anemia or thyroid dysfunction or some other conditions might also be contributing or the primary cause. Many different types of depression. Primarily I'll be talking about major depressive disorder. The differentiation of like bipolar disorder to major depressive disorder is someone with bipolar disorder has an episode of mania, mood elevation, lack of sleep, increase in kind of risky type behaviors. That's the differentiation between the two. And often when we see patients who have a bipolar disorder, they don't come in those states. They come in when they're depressed. And we have to kind of tease out and find out, which is of critical importance, because if we don't identify that, antidepressants alone can trigger a manic episode in somebody with bipolar disorder. But many different types of depression, and often with that diagnosis, leads to different treatments. So what is depression? It's a lot more than sadness. It's complete loss of joy, pleasure in things. Sleep disturbances. Probably what you see most notably in sleep is they're waking up often in the middle of the night. They're waking up earlier than they intend to be sleeping or wake up. They're exhausted. They're tired. They can't focus. Their memory's affected. I mean, I've talked with Dr. Okamoto, where you see also that integration too within our spiritual growth. Hard to keep focus in a sermon or reading scripture if one can't concentrate or have any type of ability where their memory is just completely affected. Appetite disturbances. Problem more what we see often is appetite suppression, sometimes very notable weight loss. And then tragically, this is an illness where thoughts of self-harm occur and tragically can lead at times to suicide. So what are the different medications that we have? There's a lot of different medications. I'm not going to go into great deal detail about all of them. The original medications, or some of the older ones, what we call the MAOI inhibitors. These are medications you don't see as commonly prescribed, primarily because there's a lot of dietary restrictions to them. If you eat certain foods, you might have your blood pressure go extremely high. So because of those food restrictions, you don't see psychiatrists as often prescribing them. We have the tricyclic antidepressants, one of them, if you're familiar with the name or not, nortriptyline. A lot of primary care physicians actually prescribe nortriptyline for migraine, headaches, chronic pain. And I'll see a lot of patients who come in who are taking that medication, they're actually unaware that that's an antidepressant. And we don't maybe use those medications as much because of sometimes side effects of dry mouth, constipation, kind of feel a little bit groggy on it. But when the SSRIs came out, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you know, probably most known is Prozac, other medications, Zoloft, Lexapro. Those medications are probably what are more still commonly prescribed. I mean, I was talking earlier about where we are in great need of new treatments because, frankly, the effectiveness of treatments has not changed in decades. I mean, if you're on television, and I don't know the latest commercials. I kind of stopped my cable a long time ago, but if you're watching some commercial and it's like, wow, this is the latest and greatest that came out, the older medications are just as effective. I mean, it might be maybe your genetic background or for whatever reason you have something specific that might respond more favorably to a newer medication, but the medications that we've had for a long time are just as effective. What psychiatrists are probably better at relative to our primary care colleagues is sometimes knowing maybe some subtleties with the medications that might be able to help some areas of depression. For instance, Wellbutrin, individuals who feel a bit lethargic, kind of a stimulating type antidepressant, has off-label use for ADHD, so might be able to help somebody with concentration, doesn't carry some side effects like you see with the other medications. Medications, the SNRIs, these are the serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. You see, also helpful for patients who have chronic pain. You know, we have a prescription opioid epidemic that's happening in this country, and so ourselves and a lot of our other colleagues in pain management, we try to find alternatives for managing pain, and actually using these medications is one of them. Some of the newer medications, antidepressants, Vibrid, Fetsema, Trintellix. Brain stimulation, electroconvulsive therapy. I don't personally do electroconvulsive therapy, but I've witnessed the procedure actually many times. Probably the most effective treatment for depression. I've seen people go through several different trials and medications, never come out of their depression, and when they get ECT, it's like their life comes back. The other one that maybe you've heard or not is repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or RTMS. This is another procedure that is FDA approved for treatment of depression To qualify, you have to have one failed attempt on an antidepressant. And it's a procedure where you can actually go and get the procedure done and go back home. You don't necessarily have to have someone drive you to have the procedure, because ECT is with an anesthesiologist. And it's basically, you know, it's a procedure where you need to have somebody who's looking after you when it's getting done. But RTMS can be very effective. In particular, I've had some patients who had real challenges with side effects on antidepressants, and they found that RTMS was preferable and very effective for them. Lifestyle, exercise. I mean, exercise can do some remarkable things for helping on depression. What I often tell people when you're depressed, you have no motivation, you have no drive to do things. And if their baseline understanding of exercise is that, you know, I got to go to the gym for, 40 minutes, I'll tell them, just go for a brief duration. Just go for 5 minutes. And preferably, maybe get outside, get some sunlight. You know, we live here in beautiful Southern California. You get out and we can enjoy this weather with some exercise. Also, nutrition, sleep hygiene. Good sleep hygiene. A lot of us have bad habits with sleep, in particular our electronic devices. A lot of us like looking at our mobile devices, our tablets before we go to sleep at night. Really affect our sleep. Our brain's ability to make melatonin, which helps us sleep, is drastically affected by these devices. It almost confuses our brain that it's daylight out. So I'll tell patients to put away the devices at minimum an hour before bedtime. Trying to find things to focus one's attention and gauge that is not an electronic device. Is it reading a book? Is it journaling? I actually have a lot of patients who get those kind of adult coloring sketches, and they'll just work on those at night, because it takes, you can't, your worries and other things that are going on that maybe is preventing you from going to sleep at night, you can engage and think into something different. And then also taking melatonin, anywhere from 3-5 milligrams definitely is what we recommend. Our sleep colleagues will recommend melatonin. If you ask our sleep colleagues anything else for sleep, they won't recommend anything else for sleep. Psychiatrists are a bit more flexible to try to help with other medications, but over-the-counter melatonin can be very effective. And other vitamin supplements, B12, vitamin D. Shockingly, when I do vitamin levels, there are so many people in Southern California who have vitamin D deficiency. We have a pastor here at Friends, and he was jokingly talking about that we spend all this money here to live here so none of us can eat, and we also spend all this money and none of us get vitamin D. We're not even enjoying the nice weather that we have outside. So you might ask your doctor to check for some vitamin levels, and that can be something that can also be a benefit. Supplements. I'll talk with my patients. I'm not trained a lot in supplements. Some people do prefer them. St. John's Wort in particular for depression is probably more popular in Europe than it is here in the United States. The one thing that I always tell patients, and this is critical, is one, they're not FDA regulated, which means that we don't know what the manufacturer is doing with these. So it's critical if you decide to take one of these supplements that you find out that it's a reputable company. And often what you'll find out is that, do they send their product to an independent lab to be tested? And that lab will confirm that this is what you're getting. There's a lecture that I attended on St. John's Wort, and they took different manufacturers who were selling St. John's Wort and had some zero St. John's Wort, nothing in it. And they had things like stimulants and a kind of amphetamine type to make individuals feel like they weren't depressed. So very important that you find out the type of company and that's producing it. And also that they do cause side effects. They do interact with your other medications. So it's critical if you take one of these supplements to let any physician that might be prescribing you a medication that you're taking one of them, because it can affect a lot of other conditions. This is kind of the hot topic in medicine, personalized medicine, where we can find out some things about your genetics or maybe imaging that we can do to really kind of pinpoint a specific treatment to help you. I think a frustrating area in mental health is that we have some limitations on really our diagnostics. A lot of it depends upon the interview that we're having. Picking medications at times, we can... we can select a medication, but maybe a patient has an unfavorable side effect reaction to it, or maybe it's a medication that's not effective. But then we do another medication, and it ends up being very helpful. But the genetics, we do not have genetic testing to diagnose mental illnesses. So the genetic testing that are out there, I think, can be effective for maybe side effects. I think that's probably, hopefully, that we're going to see, is to try to find, to try to limit maybe side effects of medications. We actually do that right now with one of our mood stabilizers, Tegretol. There's a subpopulation that has a gene that it makes them susceptible to causing Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which is a potentially lethal rash that they can get when they take Tegretol. So that's one area that you can see where genetics is being used, and I think hopefully you're going to be, or we hope to be seeing that used in the future too. And imaging, we do not have imaging that is diagnostic of mental illness. There are some leading academic facilities that are doing some brain imaging called fMRI to try to help understand what's going on in the human brain with some of these disorders. But we do not have that, the technology right now that's diagnostic. It's something that we would like, but we don't. And what I always encourage people, if they're wondering, you know, hey, I heard that there's this brain image I can get, or there's this test I can get that can help me really diagnose and specify things, sometimes I'll just say, look at what are the major institutions throughout this country doing? What's Harvard doing? What's UCLA doing? And we don't have that. They're working on some things to try to get there, but this is not something that we have that's commonplace in practice. And so we're kind of left with some limitations, but still we can find effective treatments. This is some exciting things, hopefully kind of pinpointing maybe the future of what we're gonna see in our treatments. I don't know if any of you are familiar with ketamine. Ketamine is a medication, primarily anesthesiologists are using ketamine. And what we saw remarkably is that patients who had ketamine were coming out of depression within like 48, 72 hours. I mean, almost instant coming out of it. I mean, you take an antidepressant and it takes weeks to come out of depression. To have something that's almost instantaneous is remarkable. The problem with ketamine is it's not a treatment that I think is recommended for. It has some pretty notable side effects. We don't see it as really a medication that is sustainable for maintenance on helping depression. But what it does point to is an area of possible medications that we can look at. What it affects is, I put the glutamate system. There's all of these different neurotransmitters that are helping treatments for depression, but we don't really have anything that basically addresses the glutamate system. So that might be a new area for helping. Anti-inflammatories, hopefully we're gonna see. This medication, Tianine, that's a medication actually that's not here in the United States, but affects glutamate, has anti-inflammatory responses, does some pretty remarkable things, so who knows, maybe someday we'll see that medication here. In closing, I am a physician for Kaiser Permanente, and I want to put a slide up just in case that there are some attendees here who have Kaiser Permanente insurance. Some of the things I really like about being a Permanente physician, especially in mental health, is you have direct access to see a psychiatrist or a therapist. You don't need a referral. So you can call that telephone number that I listed at the top, and you can get a direct appointment to see somebody within our department. We have a 24-hour crisis line that you can call at any time. And when you call that, your physician is notified, maybe in the middle of the night that you had a difficult time. We have locations for psychiatry, Aliso Viejo, the Anaheim Euclid office, Harbor MacArthur, Laguna Hills, Santa Ana Tustin. And we also have a great addiction department that we collaborate, work along with quite often. We have offices there in Laguna Hills and Orange. We have obviously emergency services at the medical center, and that's where I've been spending more of my time transitioning into that role, spending a bit more time with some of my other medical colleagues. And then you can always look on kp.org for any other helpful information on mental health. So that concludes my talk on this morning. Again, thank you all for coming here, inviting me. It's an honor to be here. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy the day.
Awesome job. Thanks for the heavy lifting. And there are a number of believing psychiatrists in the Kaiser system. So that was a very nice surprise.
Yeah. Just within the UCLA office where I was at, you know, I find that three or four. I probably met three or four other Christian psychiatrists just within the UCLA office. And so they're out there. There's a lot. It's not something that we're openly talking about, but sometimes in a conversation I'll come across. So there are a fair amount of Christian psychiatrists that are out there within the Permanente system. And I think as a reflection, too, in the greater community. So.